Welcome to Seemingly Ordinary. I'm back with Adam Clement, who is a licensed therapist and has helped out married couples and has helped people out with addiction and trauma and neuroses and basically pretty much everything you could think of. But today we're going to take a very different tact than usual. We are going to actually talk about personal finance because he has a background and a history and education in personal finance, and that plays into every relationship. And so I like to kind of think that money can buy happiness. I've read that psychologists say that it can. Usually if people buy experiences and if they are generous, then these actions actually create happiness. And I do think money is essential. I've read that when people go from, say, poverty to middle class, or maybe from middle class to upper middle class, they actually do experience a boost in happiness. Maybe that's because they moved to a safer neighborhood with less crime. And then also entrepreneurs, people who created something out of nothing, those people have kind of a boost in happiness too. So I guess we're here to maybe give some psychological advice. Adam's here to give the psychological advice. He's here to correct my wrong ideas. And I'm just here to pose questions mostly. But I'm just very excited about this because I think money comes into so many things. And, you know, they say money fights and money problems can be a big cause for divorce. So we want to make sure that people are able to stay together and be happy and just to be prosperous in general and to not starve or have to live in a bad neighborhood, etc. Just all those type of things. So I'm just very excited, Adam, to have you back.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Excited to talk about this. Yeah, kind of a dusting off some more of a specific of my history and going back to personal finance and how, funnily enough, I might talk a little bit about how that actually led me to doing more specifically counseling, kind of stemmed off of my background in personal finance. So I think it's kind of a fun kind of rejuvenation of that side of my professional, let's say, background.
Yeah. Well, how about you give us just a little bit of your background on that, like how you got into helping people with personal finance. And also, I want to mention that Adam is one of those people who walks the walk because he is a successful small business owner and employs other people, provides jobs and things like that for other people and meets payroll. So he's not the guy who wrote the book, How to Get Rich. And that was the only thing he ever did. And he got rich off of writing the book, How to Get Rich. And turns out that the answer is write a book called How to Get Rich. He is not that guy. He is the guy who actually has, you know, saved, invested, started his own business, hired other people. He knows his stuff. So So give us your background a little bit.
Yeah, okay. So I went to K-State, Kent State University, and I studied accounting and personal finance. So I had a business kind of minor in background, and personal finance was my degree. And I did have some like internships that I did while I was working on that. And through that process, a lot of what I kind of found on the psychological level was what kind of intrigued me quite a bit. So, like, we worked on the product side. We worked on, like, investments and tax and all that. And we would, like, kind of counsel people through that as well with this internship that I did. And one of the things that just kept piquing my interest, I had some of my colleagues that were very interested in the product side. Like, they didn't really want to have to deal with the human element. They were really good at doing, like, investigation and putting packets together and trying to fine-tune what people were saying into a plan that worked for them. And a lot of my tilt with a couple of my colleagues was more on the like experiential side of like how to build relationships, how to like help them understand the values of the clients, doing more of the relationship building for like ongoing relationships with your clientele and like reassuring them, kind of teaching and all that. Like that was the thing that certainly intrigued me a lot more.
Okay.
And so kind of I had to kind of a moment of opportunity, I suppose, where I was kind of going back and forth where I was going for a couple of different grad schools and a couple of different jobs at the same time, where it's like I could kind of go either way. I'm like, I'm really interested in kind of like the more psychology side of money and just relationships and how that works. I was also interested in like interviewing different companies that I would have done like more like financial plan, kind of jumped in, got my feet wet with that. And just as it so happened, I ended up accepting going to Abilene Christian University for my master's degree in marriage and family therapy. So I wanted to kind of incorporate finances into that. So I kind of let them know, and that's kind of a selling point of me getting accepted to that school, was kind of my business background being something unique and different to bring to my cohort. And so from there, a lot of what I study, a lot of my specialty is working with couples. I think I've mentioned to you before. And what's comes up in almost every couples counseling that I do to some degree of like the four so different major ongoing unsolvable problems of marriage being, you know, kids to some degree is a pretty common one. Everybody has them, but it's usually somewhat of a contentious point. But sex, money, and then usually relationships with in-laws is kind of a pretty big one. It's like how we have boundaries. But sex and money are two of the most common ones that every couple has to deal with. And they're what we call potential or progressive problems in relationship, because they're ones that you don't quite get rid of. You just get better at how you talk about. So they're they're perpetually something that we either increase the skill by which we talk about them, how our values play in, our different scripts on whether we prefer saving or spending or investing or what have you, like what our different goals are there. And so there's always opportunities for that. And everyone kind of grows up to some degree with their own different financial script.
Yeah. Attitude.
It's kind of the way we put it, which is just like what we think works, how somebody else did it, what we think is successful, you know, and just kind of judging off other people and kind of trying to stay in our lane. And there's good and bad about that depending on what values that we've taken on. So that's the part that I do a lot of counseling with different couples as far as helping them to integrate their different ideas, how to have them rather than – because you're not doing what I think you should be doing. You're not sabotaging me, or you don't like our family, you don't care about anything. You're just selfish. It's a lot of times we're both meaning well, but just don't know how to converse about what we're trying to accomplish. And even if our own behaviors or ideas set up success for the values that we have. So I don't necessarily always get like the fine-tuned details with couples on like what money to put where and, and all that. I usually don't go into too much specific detail, but we do go into some pretty intimate conversations on like how we speak to each other and what value money means to us. Is it freedom? Is it security? Is it prestige or class? It's a pretty profoundly impactful conversation the closer you get to somebody.
See, and I feel like these psychological ideas that people have about money could just easily be assumptions in the background and just things that maybe you've never considered at all. I remember reading a book when I was maybe, I don't know, about 29, 30 years old. And this author was basically saying, what's your attitude about money? And then I thought, do I have an attitude about money? And, you know, she kind of went on to explain that, let's just say for the sake of argument that you grew up hating rich people, like all rich people, like I just hate them. Mm-hmm. And she said, then why would he ever want to be rich? You know, like if you assume that every rich person is crooked and vicious, well, why would you want to be a crooked or vicious person? And I'm being very basic here, but for me, this was a gigantic revelation when I first ran across it. Then I kind of got into Dave Ramsey, and he does this very cute way of introducing money and relationships where he says, okay, so when you're married, you know, you want to work together with love and trust, you know, with your spouse. You definitely don't want it to be a war. You know, and he just splits the whole human race into two personality types, nerds and free spirits. And in his mind, you know, the nerd is the accountant who made a budget, who has a spreadsheet, who, you know, is thinking, oh, this investment can get me 9.5%. And, you know, if we amateurize this and amateurize that, and, you know, they're thinking numbers, et cetera, and they want to do a budget, and they're probably thrifty and frugal, and they're organized. Well, then the other person's a free spirit. They're like, party, let's have a party, let's have a good time. You know, like, we don't have to have a budget. Most people don't have to have a budget. Let's just have fun. You know, and so then he says, that's why these people are now seeing me, why they're going to my class, because now they have 9 credit cards, they've maxed them all out, they've got, you know, $70,000 in debt, they have no idea how they acquired this debt in the first place, and then their marriage is on the verge of collapse because they're fighting over things. But, you know, the fundamental assumption going in was one person's, well, I'm a nerd, you know, spreadsheets, and then the other one is, I'm a free spirit, party animal. Animal House, whatever, you know, And so I thought, hey, good enough. You know, I mean, obviously there's 8 billion personality types because there's like 8 billion people. But I thought, hey, you know, this psychology aspect to money is actually very important. You know, because, well, what if I have the attitude that I'll never have money, things don't work out for me? Then on what level do I make that actually come true? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the kid who goes, oh, I'm no good at math. You know, so then, well, why would he try hard in math class? The only thing he wants to do is avoid it. Mm. So I don't know if I'm speaking intelligently or if I'm just giving you psychobabble.
Well, I think there's something to that as well, because I think some of it speaks to just like maturity in general, like the challenge for most people, like with whatever lessons that we've learned and how we justify our own behaviors in the short term. Money in some ways is no different than a lot of other maturation processes, which is, am I just looking at the short term, just what I can afford right now, or am I, you know, more concerned with the long term and taking care of things, in which case I might be willing to sacrifice a little bit of discomfort to invest in the future. Mm. I think they did a study here not too long ago that that married men on average make more than non-married men, which I thought was just kind of a fascinating concept, because you would assume it's kind of the opposite, right? You assume
that,
like,
non-married
men have all kinds of money and they're just having fun all the time, and married men, they're just scrounging bikes, they're paying for things.
Okay.
But by and large, a vast majority of, let's say, like unmarried men will work as hard or as necessary as they need to be able to make whatever they need for like the beer money for the weekend, and won't really push or try to do anything more than that because they're just looking for the short-term gains. Mm. And a lot of the married men are ones that are like, okay, I need to, you know, ask for raises and make myself like indispensable in the workforce, and are much more likely to like really work hard because they have things to take care of at home.
Because so they've got a family.
They have that greater responsibility. They're thinking longer in the future, and they're considering more things to where the sacrifices and pushing a little bit harder is more, let's say there's more of a reason to do that. We're thinking long term versus, yeah, if you're unmarried, it's like, well, I don't necessarily need to. I'm only taking care of me. How hard is that?
I can live for today.
Yep. And so there's a higher likelihood to where, and yes, there are certainly like outliers on either end of that. There are outliers where there's like extremely hardworking, let's say single men and women that are like very top of their game, but there's such a small percentage as opposed to the greater workforce, which is, you know, between married and unmarried individuals, the married ones tend to seek out work harder and tend to invest more in their future and are much more diligent with their money, much more intelligent about it than their counterpart around the same age or demographic that's single.
I don't know if you ever read The Millionaire Next Door or The Millionaire Mind. They're by an economist, a guy named Thomas Stanley. And he's Dave Ramsey's mentor, apparently. This guy must be about 95 or 100 years old by now. But he said in his books, he had done surveys. He had surveyed 1,500 millionaires across the United States, and he would give them these extensive surveys because he was a university professor, and that's just how he rolled, you know. And he said 87% of self-made millionaires in the United States have a very supportive spouse. And my uncle, who was filthy rich, you know, at the age of 95, probably had $6 or $7 million, something like that. He just always said, you know, everything is so much easier if you have two horses pulling in the same direction. You know, those old-fashioned metaphors.
Sharing burdens together tends to look better.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically saying, well, people are inspired because they have a spouse, they have children, and so they have extra incentive to work hard and to plan ahead. You know, whereas maybe the single guy just wants to party all the time. Yeah. You know,
true. And I think if I've read those books right, because I think I would have probably read those in undergrad, if I recall right.
Okay.
I think they made mention. I think Dave Ramsey has made mention as well a few times of how like a lot of these like millionaires next door are very unassuming.
Yes.
On the more phenotypical type, like what you're looking at, because they're driving like beat up cars and they're like you know living very much underneath their means, and so you'd never know like one thing or the other unless like you actually asked them questions and saw like what they're investing, what they're saving on, like what they're capable of. So part of that is that mindset of, yeah, if you're trying to keep up with everybody else and be comparative and all that, odds are you're going to live outside your means, and it's going to be constantly that short term pleasure seeking tends to be very expensive.
Yes.
Versus like people that are, you know what they're doing it for and know what they're sacrificing the short term for and know what's valuable, tend to be less likely to be swayed into current fads and spending money where they don't need to, and are much more likely to invest in the things that actually matter. So I do think that that correlates very well, that, yeah, if you have important things and values that are outside of just the short term, you're more likely to sacrifice a lot of areas that are not necessary. One of my really good friends, he's a pretty clever guy. One of my really good friends, he's an architect, and he talked about, I think he loves cars, absolutely adored them. Like, he grew up on them, had posted them in college dorm and all that kind of stuff. Was like a gearhead. And I think as soon as he graduated, like the first thing he did, they bought like this old Mustang that he just loved this car, thought it was the greatest thing ever.
Okay, cool.
And I think it was
1969 Mustang.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I think it might have been shortly after they had their first child, I think, somewhere around there.
They traded it for a minivan.
And he I think he had this like come to Jesus moment of like really thinking through, like, this isn't practical. It's way too expensive. Like, I'm like, the tires are like in such a way I'm burning them out all the time. It's like, it's so expensive upkeep. Like, they ended up buying, I think they bought a minivan at some point, but also it's like a car for them to have these two cars. Like, they got rid of that one, like, dropped down their like payments for the car and everything down so much. And he's like, yeah, like, it's taking me from point A to point B. Like, I'm not like racing it. I'm not doing anything amazing with it. It basically is just like a status thing that once I had like family and kids, like, it's not that important. In fact, yes. It actually makes it look worse, because then it makes me look more selfish than actually doting upon my family.
Yes.
And so he had like a really kind of like specific, like, let's say psychological, somewhat like breaking point, like financially. He's like,
yeah,
is this really worth it? Like, what is the actual utility and point of this, as opposed to these other things that are more important?
Was he embarrassed by it? Well, I just want to tell
like later on.
Yeah, no, I don't mean after he got rid of the car. I mean, was embarrassment part of getting rid of the car? You know, because you just said, okay, maybe people are looking at me now because, well, you've got a wife and you've got a kid and you've got this expensive Mustang.
And I would say yes to a degree. And he's a pretty staunch Christian himself. So like, I do think there was something to that. I think it was, I think I'll put it this way, as far as the way he would describe it. I think there was a combination of. I think it was attracting the kind of people he would not have wanted to attract it.
Okay.
And it was not really a selling point or anything that made him look better to the type of people that he wanted to be associated with. And so I do think it became like, okay, well, what kind of person do I want to associate with, and what kind of person do I want to be known as? And I think he was getting, you know, accolades from people that, again, would be, let's say, arguably more of a selfish, like within the workplace lifestyle, that is like, I don't know if I want that type of, you know, affirmation of my decision making, as opposed to more of his like his faith base and his more familial crowd, or kind of like questioning like what the benefit of that was.
Yeah, that moment when you realize, okay, I'm a work-a-daddy now, you know, that I really do need a minivan, and the type of people I'm associating with are going to be solidly middle class, and people are dressing a certain way for work. Just all of those type of things. Mm. Just realizing, well, this is my neighborhood. You know, you mentioned the neighborhood effect earlier. You didn't use exactly those words, but that's in Dave Ramsey, and it's also in Thomas Stanley.
Like, keep up with the Joneses. So
yeah, and Dave Ramsey basically says, if you try to keep up with the Joneses, you just need to realize the Joneses are broke and they're in debt. Mm-hmm. And so Thomas Stanley found out, like you said, these millionaires, these future millionaires, I guess I'm talking about like middle class people who end up having about $2 or $3 million when they retire. Mm-hmm. Those were the type of people Thomas Stanley referred to as the millionaire next door.
Yes.
So these are plumbers, firefighters, cops, teachers, librarians, accountants, middle class types, maybe engineers, or maybe people who are making slightly less than the median income, janitors. These are the people who decide, well, okay, so if my income every year is the median income, let's say that's $55,000, then I would prefer to live in a neighborhood where maybe the average person is making about $42,000. And this way you don't get sucked into the whole neighborhood effect, because mm-hmm. we humans are great imitators. We see what everybody else is doing. We get inside the elevator. We all face the front. When we guys go to the public restroom and there's five other guys in there, nobody says anything. When the women go in there, everybody says something. You know, we are just like great imitators. Mm-hmm. And so apparently if you live in a fancy neighborhood, you're going to spend as though you have that type of income. But if you go to the neighborhood where everybody's making, say, $40,000 a year, then you're going to start spending like those people who make $40,000 a year. That's kind of what he found. Mm-hmm. And so that was important.
That's like the idea of social mimosis, which is like the idea of, You're kind of putting it perfect. It's we tend to mirror things that are around us socially, kind of as a means of fitting in, but also as like we're trying to understand what is valuable and what's not. And, and there is something about that that's helpful. Like if you, there are good and bad versions of peer pressure, like seeing people that are doing healthy things and, you know, engaging in behaviors that are worthwhile. It's sometimes good to like see what other people are doing and be able to look at, okay, who is successful, who's living out their values, and then what are they doing to do that? And then there's also the passive, more of I'm just – it's a kind of joke about like Rolex to some degree. It's like, why is Rolex, you know, so expensive? Well, because everybody wants one and everyone assumes that you have to have it because everybody else has it. But even like the current phenomenon, like the Stanley Cups, I don't know if you've heard about the whole thing about the Stanley Cups. Yeah, there's quite a run on. So it's the brand Stanley. They have like thermoses and whatnot. And, and like in the last month or so, for whatever reason, I don't know like how far it stretched or what degree, but I'd heard on several different like podcasts and different things to where like just women were going absolutely crazy over like having like every different color and size and shape of these different Stanley Cups. Like it became like this big thing. Like it made like water taste better. I'm very joking about this, but like it's like, oh yeah, it tastes better. I'm more likely to drink it. It's a status symbol effectively. And so it's like there's this run on like Stanley Cups for like the craze, and like they were getting sold out, and people were like tackling each other at stores because they all had to have this new fancy specific cup, right?
Okay, it's the update of the, I don't know, the 1980s Beanie Baby or whatever.
Yeah, fair, yeah.
Okay.
Yep, to where, yeah, there was just this desire
to... Cabbage Patch Kid Stanley Cup hula hoop.
Yeah, once somebody said it was important and once enough people kind of bought into that, it kind of takes off like a virus and a social contagion to where everybody has to have it. And you don't know why, but because everyone else wants it, I don't want to be left out. I need to have one too. And so, yes, there's something about that social mimosis where like if we see other people doing things like, oh, is everybody doing that? Is that what we should be doing? Is there a good reason behind that? I see what they're doing. I don't understand why. So let's just repeat whatever else is doing and see if we pull value out of
it. That's right.
That doesn't always go very well because if we don't know the value behind it, even if other people, let's say, purchase or showcase things that are good for them and they've really sorted out their values, they understand why they're doing it, trying to mimic that without understanding the why they do it or where it comes from is at best hollow, if not somewhat sabotaging of your own plans.
Yes, yes. Okay. I would like to ask you about... I think maybe three major philosophies of money. And then if you know of a fourth or a fifth one, we can discuss these as well. Because you know, we just kind of got done discussing how, let's say you have a married couple and one of them's a spender and the other one's a saver. Well, you know, then that's kind of a clash of values. And if they can figure out a way to talk and come together, then great. Well, some people come up with whole models of money. So I want to ask you about two very popular ones, which is Dave Ramsey, you know, with his seven baby steps and his budgeting and his couple should get along with love and trust. I think that's his model. And, you know, he basically would say that this is countercultural because so few people are doing it because he hates debt with all of his heart. And he thinks that, you know, debt is risk and debt is slavery. And so he thinks what he's doing is countercultural because he's trying to get people out of debt and to save and invest. So let's see. Then there's Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote Rich Dad Poor Dad, which my understanding is that is the most successful personal finance book in world history, that nothing has sold more copies than Rich Dad Poor Dad. And, you know, both these guys are actually great storytellers. Like, if you read the book, they tell good stories. They really do. And they're pretty light on the numbers. They'll give you enough numbers that you can understand kind of what they're talking about. You know, like Robert Kiyosaki is like, well, I took out a $250 loan and this helped me put down a down payment on the house, which I later flipped and made $100,000 on. And I did this over the course of 10 days. So I made $100,000 in 10 days. Like he's, you know, he'll give you enough numbers that you know what he's kind of talking about. Then I think a third philosophy is I'm just going to call it let money flow. You know, like don't worry about money, just spend money. And money will come in. So I don't know if it's kind of a mystical approach or what it is. But so I don't know. Do I need to say anything more to outline the philosophies? Like with Dave Ramsey, I probably should just sort of recite he's got these seven baby steps. And he thinks that people should follow these baby steps because this is a plan that works for everybody. If you have big debts or if you have net worth of zero or if you have $5 million in the bank, these seven baby steps work for 99.99% of the population. The first step is you need an emergency fund of $1,000 because what if you get four flat tires? The second one is you need to pay off your debts from smallest debt to largest debt. So if you owe your mom $5, give her that $5. And then if you owe the credit card company $500, they're next. And if you owe the next credit card company $10,000,
then they're next. And snowball them into each other.
Yeah. So you take the smallest one to the biggest one. Then you build that emergency fund up to 3 to 6 months worth of your salary in case something really disastrous happens. Like what if you get fired or something? Well, now you got 6 months living expenses in the bank. So you have some time, you know, for looking for a new job. Steps 4, 5, and 6 happen simultaneously. Those are save 15% toward retirement, pay off your house early, and also save up for the kids' college education if they're going to go to college. The last step is, okay, now you've covered everything. You've paid for the house, you've paid for college, you're out of debt. So now you can save and invest and give money away and live like nobody else. And now it's the time to do whatever the heck you feel like doing. Get a sports car, go to Hawaii, whatever. So that's kind of the day plan. And he insists that couples should work together with love and trust. And they should try to get along. And they should not have World War III. You know, that they should truly love each other and talk to each other and work with each other and compromise with each other. So I think that's his plan in a nutshell, you know. So, and he's all about frugality. Yeah. Like, if you're in debt, don't go out to eat. Eat at home.
Yeah, you know? Everything is cash. Like, yeah, get rid of credit cards, put it in the freezer if you need to. Everything is like, you have your money allotment in different things.
He hates credit cards. There's so many videos of him cutting up credit cards with the scissors. He's like, and he insists that he's countercultural. And I guess that's pretty countercultural.
Yeah. And I think there's something nice about that, because I think it is kind of, so something, it's very simple. And I'm not saying that as a critical thing. I think he simplifies things for people to just have a plan and something in mind, like help them see repetitious behavior or different mindsets to work on, whether it works for everybody or not, as far as like if that's the best or worst plan for them. Yeah. I think there is something very tangible, like, okay, well, here's a couple of things that you can do. Here's things that got to get you on the right track. And I'm sure there are people that deviate and find alternatives and things that work with that. But I think it's just the fact that he has a plan at all to sell, I think, is part of the reason why it's so successful and so useful. Because people are desperate, like, just rather than going from day to day and just assuming that what they're doing is the best thing or getting different advice from different people and trying to amalgamate, I think just having anybody sell them on, like, here's a step-by-step process that works. And by all means, like, I think it's something to like, deviate and specify to what your finances are. But just having any plan at all is actually quite helpful rather than floundering around not having any idea.
I always feel like plan beats no plan. I always feel like actually everybody does have a plan, but the problem is they don't know it because they inherited it from somebody else. I asked myself when I first heard about Dave Ramsey, where did I get all my financial ideas? And then I realized, well, I probably got about 3/4 of them from my parents. And then I think I got the other 1/4 of them from Yahoo News and just some random commercial that I heard on the radio and just something that
of course, like different movies or like things we're watching, different images of what we think like middle class looks like versus wealthy and all this. Like we're constantly bombarded with images of comparison, which is a relatively new phenomenon, like in the last like 100+ years of just like have like not just like being in your own community, but now we have like such access to a perception, a visualization of all these different cultures, all these different ways of doing things to where it's making people have a really hard time of knowing what is reasonable, what works, or even getting things in their proper order.
Right.
So I do think people are overwhelmed with the idea that, well, if I'm not like the most wealthy person I've seen on TV, I must be failing entirely rather than trying to, let's say, see if they could do better than they did yesterday and constantly trying to grow themselves. It's, well, if I'm not as good as, you know, these people on TV, then I just, you know, I'm going to give up and just complain all the time and not try to get out of my station or try to do something different. Or it's just like, no matter what I do, I'm not quite there yet. So I think it can be somewhat disheartening to, let's say, not just compare yourself to people of relatively similar status and try to get better. It's just, well, if I can't become the best, I'm just going to settle for nothing.
Do you run into that? Do you feel like you see people just, okay, they do that?
I have a few people, even like I'm thinking of like in my clinical practice that I see, I have a few people, I have a couple of different and it's kind of a sad thing. It's kind of gotten like into blue-collar workforce as well. But I have a few blue-collar workers that are very much of that mindset of like that they just hate billionaires, hate wealthy people. Like I think you mentioned kind of earlier. And like they're so detesting that idea that they're almost like willing to –
it's like self-sabotage and not try anything different. Like there's opportunities for like growth into management or taking on different positions. They're like, yeah, but I don't want to like be in charge of the people because anybody who manages is just the worst. I just want to be
right.
like on the lowest end. I want to be able to do my own thing. I don't want anybody to tell me what to do or have to tell anybody else. And so they're almost like strategically sabotaging themselves for fear of what that means and what they've like perceived like management or having wealth to look like.
Okay.
And so rather than – it's almost like a rather than try to – increase their status, they would rather tear down people who have more.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a sad thing that's developed over just time.
I feel like that does happen psychologically, that people figure out that you don't have to do a single thing to improve yourself if you can just put somebody else down. Because now you're taller than that other guy because, well, you just kneecapped him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you haven't done anything to improve whatsoever. You know, like you didn't improve your grades or your looks or your finances or your relationships or anything. You just, you know, belittled that other person and now supposedly you stand taller.
Yeah, it's hard to see the high ground when everyone's standing in the mud.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so kind of getting back to Dave Ramsey, I want to ask, you said a lot of positive things, and I think mostly positive things about Dave Ramsey. I honestly do.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you think Dave Ramsey might not be for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Or can you think of cases where, okay, this guy over here was much better off not doing Dave Ramsey? Because, I mean, Dave Ramsey, that's the, you know, hey, suck it up, buttercup,
work to some degree, hard, it's depending
eat
on
good
how you...
food, exercise, don't eat any sweets. Like, he's all about sacrifice.
Yeah. A lot of times it depends on what your values are and how you incorporate that, like with family, friends, or otherwise. So I'll say it this way. I think that with anything that gets to that level of prolification, so where like they just like everyone knows kind of who he is. The problem is like people can take or pick apart anything that he says and apply to themselves.
That's right. They can say, I don't like his philosophy on insurance.
Or it's like they're so dedicated to like just the concepts without applying to themselves effectively to the point where they're not really coordinating with their family, with their spouse. They're not actually trying to do a good job. It's just, here's what he said, so I'm not going to let you get anything that you want. Like, we're cutting out everything fun. We're not doing anything enjoyable. Like, it's going to be pure sacrifice as long as it takes. And if there's not buy-in to that, even if it, let's say, quote-unquote, works financially, it can cause quite the rift in relationship, unfortunately.
Yes.
So I do think a lot of it is – it's the risk of it being so, so big to some point that it kind of removes some of the personal touch for, like, how does any family, any couple – incorporate those values and apply it to themselves and decide what's worth risking and what's not. And I think that's the challenging thing, that it's a black and white solution that has to be somewhat grayed for each individual family and
that
individual couple
sense.
System. So I do think it's quite useful, but I think it's a lot of the risk it's run is its interpretation from family to family. I use this.
It becomes too dogmatic is kind of what I'm hearing you say.
Well,
like some people might cut out all the fun, period. And so somebody says, can I buy that 25-cent stick of gum, you know, for the month of February? You know, it's my only treat. And then if you're too dogmatic about this thriftiness, then no. You know, we're not going to go anywhere. We're not going to do anything. Suck it up, buttercup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So that could be somewhat like – and I think it has to somewhat toe that line if you're like – advertise most people, like there has to be some sacrifice, some some change of your behavior, some mindset switch. I do think there has to be something on that on the bigger scale. But I do think like once you actually get down to like breaking it down to like the family itself, it's an opportunity to talk about, okay, what is worth or what is not worth like splurging or being generous or you know, all those different things still have to be somewhat applied to the personal, the individual. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think that depending on how it's incorporated can be better or worse. I don't think the ideas are bad. I think it's the risk of
over-application, maybe?
Yeah,
well, it's kind of like working out is good, but do you want to work out 6 hours a day? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Arnold Schwarzenegger did when he was competing for Mr. Universe. I think he worked out something like 30 hours a week.
Mm.
You know, that's how much he was lifting weights.
Sure.
You know, but do you want to work out and lift weights? I don't. I don't want to. I mean, I do want to lift weights, but
I mean,
not
like
30 hours a week.
I mean, if that's your goal, like if that's your, you know, your stance that you want to be like a bodybuilder, like if that's like something like, yeah, if you're passionately dedicated to something, you're probably going to be sacrificing a lot of areas, but it's well worth it if it's in progress of something. It's very different if it's like, I just want to be lazy all the time. It's not going to probably get you very far. I remember, I use this kind of as a funny example. So I had a couple a while back that I worked with, and I think I'd seen the wife a couple times, the husband, I think I'd seen like once, and then he like didn't want to come in for a while and came back in. I think what I'd heard was he took some things that I had said in an interesting interpretation, let's
say.
Okay. So I always wonder about that. It's usually how it's interpreted and how people break it down for themselves. It was something like the wife came in and something along this, like he would, my husband, he would go golfing for the whole day and like wouldn't call me and like get drunk with his friends, wouldn't say anything. And then he'd come home and I'd be upset with him. He'd be like, well, Adam said, you know, I got to take care of myself first. So like Adam always says, you know, self-care is important and taking care of you and all that kind of stuff. So I have to be, you know, missing for several days at a time and
and
drink with the buddies and you know, not calling and cutting you off because that's good for me.
Right.
I was like, Adam. I think that's quite how I would describe something. So I always kind of give some grace and credit. Like if people are, you know, trying to help a lot of people and being very successful, you're always going to have people that misinterpret or take aspects of that, have dogmatic, you know, principles on either end of the spectrum. But I do like the fact that there are people that are trying to, let's say, reorient people on how they look and just challenge their thoughts, whether you agree with their fancy or not. I do like the idea of challenging how we incorporate and how we communicate the value we place on money, what we do with it.
Yes.
Something you mentioned earlier that I think is kind of an interesting one as well, because there's a lot of more therapeutic literature, more psychological literature on the idea that above poverty line, which interestingly, like I would say in the last like, you know, 30 plus years, like absolute poverty across the globe has almost like not been eradicated, but has been like just
it's gone
absolutely
way down.
Dealt with.
It's gone way down.
Pretty significantly, which is quite a phenomenal concept. And so what they've kind of discovered is above poverty line, so like having some access to food, transportation, like at least a roof over your head, all that kind of stuff, there is no – and this goes along with what you said earlier, but there's no direct correlation between money and happiness.
Right. Okay.
So you could be, you know – We had a couple that lived next to us at our old house. They were a couple of teachers. They didn't really have a whole lot. They had a few kids. They lived extremely Spartan, and they were probably some of the most joyful, like lovely people that we ever knew.
Yeah.
And we've known people that have, you know, more money than they know what to do with that use it against each other and weaponize it and becomes very bitter and spiteful. And it gets to what it's used for. But something you mentioned earlier is it's not so much the money itself that makes you happy or not. What you mentioned earlier in kind of the introduction was, well, it's what you use it for, what you invest in. Is it stuff trying to compare yourself, or is it new experiences, new enlightenment, new wisdom for you? Is it, you know, you want to have just enough money to finally pay for being lazy and not doing anything, or is it, you know, I'm an entrepreneurial and I want to reinvest in something and keep trying to be generous and giving with that and help other people? And so again, yeah, the idea of, you know, how much money you have is not nearly as interesting as what you endeavor to do with that money, how you perceive its utility, its function, does it serve you, or are you serving it? And that's where a lot of people kind of get stuck.
If it's,
I just have to have enough money to not do anything.
Yeah.
Life's going to be miserable just with that mindset alone.
I think so. I think if you're doing nothing, you are probably going to get very depressed. You know, and just my understanding is there are horrible statistics about people who retire and then die 2 years later. And I think oftentimes it's because they're not retiring to something. They're not like running to something. They're just getting away from something. And I just think people have to have a meaning and a purpose, you know, in their existence. And, you know, thank God for religion, you know, because it supplies it for a tremendous number of people. I want to ask you just a few scenarios in terms of money maybe causing happiness, and you could comment on these just a little bit.
Absolutely.
I do think if I go from poverty to middle class, there is a boost in my happiness. True or false, do you think?
I would say yes. The question there is, and again, I guess
all things being equal.
Yeah, all things equal. The therapist to me said, well, it depends. I'm a big person on that. It depends on how you got there. If it's like through diligence and through working over time you got that versus like you had a landfall of money. The question is stability, right? Because anything that is a pursuit of happiness, there's two ways we pursue that. There's short-term pleasure and long-term joy and contentment. And so if it's you're given something abruptly, the odds are you're going to crash down very quickly if you haven't figured out how to earn and sustain that versus if you're diligent and intentional and you're let's say the quality by which you address money, like you eventually get to that point of middle class, the odds are you're more likely to stay there, appreciate the value of it.
Because you took a little while to get there and you don't want to go back.
Yeah, I think I forgot the statistics on this. It's like somewhere like around 90%, give or take, in the last study of like people that win the lottery that go back to being impoverished within like a year.
It's pretty big. And okay, here's something I read and I firmly believe it, but I want your take on this. Okay, so you have two guys and they each basically acquired $2 billion. The first guy bought a lottery ticket and then received $2 million after taxes.
Okay.
The second guy was an entrepreneur, and he worked pretty diligently for about 4 years or so. And, you know, he had a few lucky breaks along the way, but he also had some 50 and 60 hour weeks and things like that. And so they both, bottom line, now they both acquired $2 million after taxes. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the lottery ticket winner 1 year later is actually more miserable and more depressed, that his mood is actually deteriorated after mm-hmm. a year, but the entrepreneur is happier. And it's mm-hmm, mm-hmm. not necessarily the money that's making him happier, but it's the fact that the money is a symbol that he built something that people want, and he is serving other people, and other people appreciate him, and thus he appreciates other people. In other words, he built and created and worked for something. And so it's the building and the creating and the working that's making him happy. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on scenario A and B?
I'll kind of come at this from a stress analysis, if that's all right, psychologically. Yeah. So there's kind of like two fundamental ways in which we address stress, which is just change, generally speaking, neither good nor bad. It could be positive stress, things that you're passionate about, interested in, just as much as distressing mm-hmm. situations. Okay. So something has changed and you're forced to acclimate to the stress, right? So there is the way in which you try to adapt or incorporate what's happened, or try to avoid and dismiss what happened, right? And so there's kind of the two pathways there that we can take as far as how we address change pretty dramatically, right? Like try to change nothing about ourselves, or try to adapt and try to become a different person because of that stress, whether good or bad.
Okay.
So that part's where you have the choice, is whether we adapt or whether we avoid. That's kind of the piece that we have some control of, right?
That's what this is boiling down to, adapt or avoid?
Yeah, more or less. Okay. And then there's the outcomes to that, right? Which you don't have complete control of the outcomes, but you do have control of, let's say, which category of outcomes you want. Mm. So I'll start with the bottom and work my way up. So let's say you avoid things, right? To where something new happens, good, bad, or otherwise, and you just choose to disregard it, don't want to talk about it, don't want to deal with it, just want to keep doing what you've always done. So whether it's good or bad news, you just want to keep things the same as you possibly can.
Okay.
A certain, let's say, comfort or familiarity. Well, the interesting thing there is the best case scenario you could possibly hope for, if your tilt is towards avoidance, is that you're going to have anxiety.
Mm.
Is the best case scenario. The worst case scenario I'll come back to. But the best case scenario is anxiety, right? Because essentially the idea of avoidance is, well, avoidance worked temporarily, short term.
It did. I had status quo. Yep. I liked it.
So it worked. But what you essentially convince yourself is, oh, so I should do that more often. I should avoid more and more things. Oh. I should do that more and more often. Okay. So where the long term is, you've now convinced yourself of a certain weakness or inability, or this idea that you have to wait until things happen to you. You don't have the authority and oversight to change something yourself.
Wow.
So the best case scenario is, well, I'm just going to wait again for life to happen to me, hopefully in a good way, because I have no, let's say, assertiveness to try to actually forge something for me. So the best case scenario is things worked out short term.
Yes.
And I've convinced myself that I have to have other people take care of me. Mm. So that's not a very fun place to stay long term. But yeah, it works every once in a while. Fair enough. Rarer that it works, but it can. The worst case scenario, and this happens much less often.
Okay.
But it still happens in that avoidance tendency to where trying to keep things the same, refuse opportunity, or keep things where they're at, you are unavoidably presented with how much worse things are because you did that. Mm. So there's a guilt associated with it. So not every time do we avoid something do we get feedback that your avoidance made it worse. Sometimes it's just you kick down the road and you seem okay at the short term. Mm. But sometimes, let's say like, you know, your boss wants to call you in and you're terrified of going in because you don't want to get, you know, in trouble or anything else. You keep avoiding it, keep calling in sick, keep trying to do whatever you can to postpone having to deal with boss, and then you find out that they want to offer you a promotion, and through fear of what could happen or not wanting to deal with it, and you just kept avoiding it until you found out that somebody else got the job because you just never showed up and you never presented yourself.
Okay.
That's certainly a rarer option, that you're presented with an obvious consequence to your avoidance. What tends to happen is you avoid things, things keep seeming fine. But as life goes on and it gets harder, you're more and more convinced that you can't do anything about it.
Mm.
That's not a fun way to treat your own mentality.
It's kind of like a learned helplessness type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I avoid things enough, then eventually I think, well, okay, I like everything the way it is, and even if I don't, there's not a damn thing I can do about it anyway.
It's kind of the metaphor of the bull and the rope. We use this in grad school. And this is like kind of a true story they would used to use, to where like they would tie young bulls up to a tree with a relatively strong chain, and it would create a certain perimeter that it could walk around in circles, and it couldn't go beyond that. And then when these bulls got older, like they would either have the same chain or like a small rope, and this thing could just like twitch its neck slightly and it would just snap the tree in half.
Okay.
But it was convinced itself over just years and years that it would never ever try to go beyond its perimeter. Once something was tied to its neck, it had convinced itself that it couldn't go beyond that, and so they wouldn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, same bull, same rope, maybe a slightly bigger tree, but this bull could just tear this tree down and run away, but it's not going to because it's just been trained this way.
Classical conditioning. It's been trained to not ever question that.
Okay, so in my original scenario, is the guy who won the lottery, is he that person that he just had this money dumped in his lap, and the reason he's more miserable, say, a year from now would be because it really actually kind of upset his apple cart a little bit, because maybe he didn't like his job and was complaining about it all the time. So then he hurried up and quit once he had that $2 million. But now he sort of misses the coworkers and the crappy coffee.
Yeah, fair. It might be some like, there's lack of purpose or all that. Or like money might frivolously spent on just fun or short-term enjoyability and all this. And
after a month, he's bored out of his wits and, you know, can't figure out a way to amuse himself. And there's only so much doom scrolling he can do on his phone.
And without a certain, like, say, healthy mentality, I mean, that's where you get a lot of examples. Is it called the 27 Club? Is that what it was? Like a lot of celebrities, a lot of, I think, like actors and musicians. Is that
Jimi Hendrix 27? Died at 27.
Like Kurt Cobain, Joplin, Amy Winehouse.
Jim Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, did Kurt Cobain die? Okay.
I think they're all around that age. It's like 27, if I remember right.
Yeah.
It's a pretty common one. And a lot of these people that are just like thrust into like just all this fame and fortune, and they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what their purpose is. They have all this stuff, and that just gives them more access to short-term damaging hedonistic behavior. And why not do that? What's stopping you?
Yeah, I'm 27. All the other rock stars are like snorting a pound of cocaine, like, you know, and so I think I'll do this too, et cetera. You know, Jim Morrison of The Doors, I used to love The Doors back in college, but gosh, you know, they said he gained a lot of weight, and there are photos of him, like when he's about 26 or so, where he'd gotten quite heavy. And before that, he was just considered to be this sex symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just there's all these photos of him when he's 23, 24, that just women just went gaga over. Well, and then they said, well, he gained all this weight, and, you know, he's not that much older. And they just basically said it was kind of like a shield. You know, it's just like, hey, everybody stop looking at me so much, you know?
A lot of terrible stuff, like a lot of child stars. Like, it's extraordinarily rare to have a child star that did not have a lot of mental issues rapidly onset because of fame and fortune and access to money and just different things. So, like, there's very few that, like, seem like – and most of them, funnily enough, like, a lot of the ones that are somewhat – let's say perceivably sane are the ones that kind of got out of Hollywood or like took like 9-to-5 jobs somewhere else, just like maintain some sense of mental sobriety.
Yeah. Which I think that would be hard to do in that world because, I mean, really seriously, who's going to be limiting you? I don't know if we talked about this before, but I always think of that as the Michael Jackson problem. You know, like, why does Michael Jackson buy the corpse of the Elephant Man and prop it up in his house? You know, why is he having, like, minors over and then he's insisting it's all very innocent, et cetera? Why is he, you know, bleaching his skin? Mm-hmm. Why is he sleeping in an oxygen tent?
That's a scary question of, like, the why not, right?
Well, the thing, I think of it as the Michael Jackson problem in this sense. Absolutely nobody can come to him and say, Michael, you're being weird. You know, but if I did that, then my family would come to me and say, you know, who do you think you are? You're a completely middle-class person. You've got this regular job. You can't do any of these things. People will think that you're a freak. You will lose your job. You will lose your friends. You will lose everything. You know, so, but in Michael Jackson's case, well, you're one of a kind. There's like nobody else like you. And so who can come to him and say, Michael, this is just way, way, way out there. This is
and
just
even if
weird.
They did, how many other let's say millions in this case, but like how many other millions of people are contradicting
yeah.
the one voice of reason who actually cares.
Yeah.
It's like, well, all my fans love it, so I'm yeah. going to keep doing it. It's like, well, the one person who desperately actually cares and is involved with you is saying, don't do this.
Yes.
And if you don't have a really strong sense of character to value, let's say, very specific persons and their ideas over the masses, uh-huh. once you're now thrust into like everyone's paying attention to you uh-huh. and you don't have a really solid understanding of who to limit your advice to, now everyone's giving you advice for what they want of you and what they can get from you, to where you're going to lose yourself pretty quick.
Yes. Okay.
So I'll go back to the stress yeah, too.
Let's go back to – I'm sorry.
What are we going to go the back stress, to? The stress, the positive okay,
yeah,
side
yeah,
of stress.
Yeah, yeah. Please do. Please do. So we'll tie that back into money.
So somebody got $2 million. Let's say they do the more adaptation route,
yeah.
right? So like
yeah.
they want stress to change them, good or bad. They want to learn and grow and constantly fine-tuning themselves, that they see new opportunities not as – an end point, was just as a new opportunity, right?
Yeah.
So this is the more challenging but the more rewarding one. So let's say we choose to adapt. We choose to keep growing and learning.
Okay.
The worst case scenario, and this is the short term versus long term, the worst case scenario is you fail.
Yes.
Which
yeah. I tried to start a restaurant. It didn't quite work out. And so maybe in a year from now, I try to start another restaurant. And well, hey, lo and behold, that one does work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep. Now, the long term consequence of that, because we'll come back to the best example. The worst case example is we fail.
Okay.
But even failure long term just becomes learning, right?
Yeah.
That just becomes new experiences, new things you understand, right?
Yeah.
So the worst case scenario, if you look at it from a long term lens, is look how much you've learned over time. Look how many new and different ways you've learned to make sense of things, to fine tune whatever next adventure you want to go mm-hmm. on. So the worst case scenario is like, yeah, you fail. It's uncomfortable for 5 minutes. In the long term, you have, let's say, invaluable knowledge that nobody else could possibly have of what mm-hmm. does and doesn't work to then apply to your next venture.
Yeah.
So that's the worst case scenario is you fail. And that happens more often mm-hmm. than the alternative.
Right.
And then the other side of this, and the word is rather important, is if you choose to adapt, there is the possibility you succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And succeed is kind of an important word there, because succeed is not something that's given to you. It's not that you just happen to beginner's luck or be good at something. But succeed is, well, through effort, you've actually achieved something. You've
yes.
worked towards something. You actually have accrued something on top of your effort that is likely to be sustainable, rather than you have nothing – you have this, you know, success thrust upon you, given to you, gifted, but you have nothing to hold and scaffold it up
right.
with. So it's going to collapse everything.
Right. Yeah. The lottery guy, you know, was just handed $2 million and doesn't know what to do with it, opts maybe for the hedonistic lifestyle, fails to adapt, and so loses the money, you know, because a lot of lottery winners are broke
mm-hmm.
later, you know, and there used to be professional athletes, like guys who had Super Bowl rings, who were homeless 10 years later. You know, my dad would tell me stories about people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but then the successful side is the ones who adapt, and that would be the entrepreneur who went from $0 to maybe $2 million, but did so over, say, a 4 or 5 year period through hard work, mm-hmm. essentially, you know, and trying things and stumbling and fumbling, but ultimately succeeding.
Yeah. And the difference there, let's say the social support, because that's a lot of where my study comes in. A lot of what I study is systemic theory. And the social support there is also interesting. Because like if you have nothing going for you and then you have this influx of cash.
Okay.
Everyone's around for that. Everybody seemingly cares short term. And you have no way of differentiating who cares and who doesn't.
Mm.
Because they're
the lottery guy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the weird cousin comes out of the woodwork and says, remember that time when we were 12 years old and we got along so great? Could I please have $100,000? And then you say, sure. And then this person just disappears after that. And, you know, so I guess that's a problem.
Mm.
People who win the lottery, then I don't know, the greedy people just come out of the woodwork asking for, well, what's $10,000 to you, buddy? You won $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Whereas if you're like the more entrepreneurial side of that,
uh-huh.
right, where you have
uh-huh.
like struggled through and created your network of people that have seen you through the hard stuff, and like friends, family, people that have gone through that with you, and that you have built up that trust. So when you do come into some cash and everybody wants a piece of that,
uh-huh.
you're more likely like, well, I'm not going to make everybody happy, but at least if the people close to me, I want to like orient to them, they're going to kind of help call me out of getting too outrageous mm-hmm. with it and too over the top, and
yeah.
and kind of keep me somewhat sane, because, well, they've gone through the process with me and they
okay.
can help me question some of like the grander things that people desire of me and want for me to do for them.
Okay.
It's like, well, okay, the people that have been there the whole time have actually tried and true through the hardships, been tested into people that you should trust more than people who short-term just want something from you.
Mm.
And so there's that social scaffolding, that mimosis of,
yes, you well, need, who cares? You need that. You need to have a better assessment of people, which I think a lot of people think they're a good judge of character. But if I earned that $2 million slowly, then I probably know I'm a better judge of character, at least when it comes to money, versus, say, the guy who just had the $2 million handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
He might be a good judge of character, but he might not be. And then, like, the people come out of the woodwork, you know, like the cousin from, you know, long ago, and can you give me $10,000? And so, okay, so kind of what I'm hearing you say is we have to adapt, because if we try to avoid, avoidance is bad. We'll probably, like, lose our money, lose our happiness, lose our health. And then I'm also hearing that we really need to be surrounded by good family and friends, you know, or at least maybe shun bad, you know, people who are going to bleed us dry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's kind of what I'm hearing from you. Two more scenarios on happiness. The first one is, can I buy happiness in terms of experiences? You know, for example, if I sign up for a dance class or a, I don't know, a fitness class or a cooking class or an arts class or a volleyball class or something, can I buy happiness? Then the second one is going to be, can I buy happiness by giving money away? You know, does generosity make me feel better? If I give $100 to my favorite charity, you know, my local church.
Sure.
You know, do these things give us a scientifically measurable boost in happiness?
Yes. And I'm thinking, I'll go with the charity one first, because that one is a bit easier to, let's say, measure and understand on the short-term versus long-term benefits of that.
Yeah.
So I'll start with that one first, because that one's kind of interesting. So again, there is a good feeling. It tends to be somewhat fleeting if it's, let's say, charitable giving, just like, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's a good thing. It could be, there's a good feeling associated with it. But there's a question of the anonymity of it. Like, if it's something you're giving to that you have a much more of an involvement in, you're kind of dictating a bit more the money goes, trying to be more hands-on, you're likely to get more benefit from it. If you're just, like, writing a check and never worried about where it's going,
okay,
there's the potential that, A, you're not going to get all that much out of it happiness-wise, and B, you're somewhat abdicating the responsibility of what's done with it.
Mm.
Because there is something to be said about, let's say, keeping local track charity of our identity.
Well, yeah, like if I give to my local church and then I see, oh, well, they're actually giving it to a family that sits across from me in the church, and, you know, I've spoken with them from time to time, and maybe it's anonymous, but nonetheless, I can see an actual impact. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that family is now going to have something for Thanksgiving, you know, versus if I give to Feed the Children of Madagascar. But I don't live in Madagascar, you know, so I, you know.
Well, and there's the hope to some degree. Yeah, some things are more credible than others. But that's the scary thing. It's like, okay, we're giving to these things that sound good, but do we actually know they're ending up good? Like, do we know what we're tracking through? Are we kind of just like anonymously don't want to deal with that?
That's right.
Because there is a cost to charitability. It can actually be somewhat detrimental if it's not taken care of properly.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we donate to some sham, you know, some bad charity. Gosh, when I was teaching college, there were these guys who said they were working for some charity that was like help the retired firemen. And it turned out they were helping themselves to like a keg party, you know, and that's where the charity dollars were going.
Mm-hmm.
They were going for like, you know, 16, you know, gallons of beer.
Yeah. Well, even like a more recent version of that, and again, not to go like too much detail on it, but there's a lot of interesting like studies and things that have kind of revealed over time, like the organization, not the concept, the organization of Black Lives Matter is a good example of that, to where all this money was donated very quickly, just very, very abruptly. And there's good intent behind what was like suggested, let's say. But even after like a couple of years, like all of the money was just like essentially accumulated by the heads of it. They bought mansions and like just squirreled away to their friends. And like none of it actually went back to the communities that they were proposing that it would. So again, like they're preying upon the generosity and the compassion of the average person, which
that's right.
Nothing wrong with, let's say, that desire for people to want to be helpful, but there's that scary thing of like how reputable is what it's going to some degree on the personal level. That's the idea of enabling. It's, let's say, you have a child and you give your child money and you find out your child's using that for nefarious purposes. They're either hurting people with it, they're taking drugs or what have you. And well, once you know what the money's being used for,
yes,
then you have that moral responsibility of, do I keep giving or do I turn that somewhere else?
That's right. That's
and so that anonymity can be somewhat damaging, because it's a very short term, like, oh yeah, I gave money away, it felt good for 5 minutes, then we get on with our lives. but to actually track and keep up with and follow through and see if what I gave was used for good or bad purposes, that is where, let's say, the true happiness comes from.
See, I buy into that completely because I spent a summer working at a homeless shelter one time. I mean, that's all I did. And I kept a journal and, you know, I got up in the morning and I did that all day until the evening and then I went to bed. And this was when I was 23 and it was just a very, very unique experience for me and it was very good. Well, I could just tell you so many stories, but you know, before I did that, I was living in kind of a slum in Milwaukee, about 6 blocks from Marquette University, and across the street was the homeless shelter. And, you know, one Sunday morning, I was walking to church, and, you know, it's always kind of cold in Milwaukee. And anyway, the snow was melting. It was kind of a nice day. It was about 33 degrees, and I was feeling pretty good about all things. And, you know, it's about 9 in the morning, and I ran into this guy that had hit me up for cash several times, and his name was Rufus. And, you know, he goes, you know, hey, can you help me out? And I say, how are you doing? And he goes, I'm pretty good. And then he changes mid-sentence and goes, I'm hurting really bad. You know, and anyway, so I gave him like 10 bucks or something like that, which at the time, as a graduate student, I was making $7,800 that year. So 10 bucks was actually kind of a huge proportion of my income, you know, not quite 1%, about 1/6 of 1%. But still, that's kind of a big chunk. Anyway, I get out of church and he's just drunk, you know, and then I think, I wonder how that happened. Then I realize I gave him 10 bucks. I caused this to happen. This is my fault. And that was a very powerful moment for me. Now, I've had people argue with me ever since. But for me, the lesson I took away from this is pick your charity shots very carefully. You know, like if you want to donate money to charity, I've heard people say after you donate that money, it's not your responsibility. I disagree. And what I'm saying is if I have two options, if I know I can give it to a family with 4 kids where maybe somebody just lost their job and these kids might not get something to eat, but if I give them 10 bucks or 100 bucks, then maybe they can get something to eat. I much prefer to do that than to just randomly give, you know, my 10 or 100 bucks to Rufus. You know, after that, I got to the point where I'm like, hey, Rufus, let's go to Subway together.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, Rufus.
That would be the idea, like you're following through on it on a personal level rather than just this, this anonymous, heady way of like, I felt good, but I'm not going to check in and see what actually happened.
Now, I mean, I have had people argue with me and they say, hey, no, it's the thought that counts. And, you know, you gave that $10 and, you know, good for you out of the charity of your hearts and such. I'm sorry. I just think like if you know more, you have more responsibility at that point. If I'm totally ignorant.
You could argue the idea that it was well-intended.
Uh-huh.
But once you know the outcome, it's the idea of, you know, to increase knowledge is to increase sorrow. Like,
yeah, okay.
Once you know something, you can't unknow. It's like, oh, yeah, it might have been purely innocent the first time.
Yeah.
But once you know, once you're aware of how things could be used, even your good intentions, things that are said, you do have that responsibility to yourself to adjust your behavior going forwards. Like, now I've had bad experiences, so I want to be that much more diligent, much more intentional than I would have been otherwise. Is first version of me innocent and good and well-intended? Absolutely.
Yes.
But good is only as relative as how quickly we adjust our values to the behaviors that are going to be best suited.
That's right. It's not good if you're ignoring what could happen.
Because then that's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing, expecting different results. Like, you have to change kind of a little of your tact in what you're doing.
I'll tell you a little experiment I've been doing with charity this year, like for the past month or two, that I've really enjoyed. Maybe I've mentioned this before. I don't know if I have. I have decided I'm just not going to give to big charities that where I don't exactly know where the money is going. Like, let's say I hear about a problem in Honduras, like, I don't know, they have an earthquake and, you know, people are like hitting you up for money. Okay, if I really feel bad, maybe I'll give some money. But for the most part, I think I would just rather give my charity dollars to people that I actually know. You know, so I've had a few former students who are now in college contact me and say things like, hey, I'm going on this mission trip or I'm doing this other demonstrably good thing. And I am thinking, hey, I've already known this person for 4 or 5 years. Plus, I know their parents. Mm-hmm. Plus, I know their brothers and sisters. I actually trust this person. So somebody asked me for something recently, and I gave them some money.
Well, there's a leap of faith to that. I think it's brilliant because it's a leap of faith. You don't know what anybody's going to do with the money.
Right.
However, let's say with some of these particular individuals, if they have built up credibility and they seem good, they can still misuse it. They can still dupe you. There's the possibility. But the odds of that are much, much smaller if you've had experiences with them over time versus like some random person's reaching out to you that you've never met before.
That's right.
And so again, like, yeah, it's a leap of faith no matter what. It's always somewhat of a risk. Like, yeah, no matter what I put out there, could be used, could be misused. I don't know that.
Yes.
But there's a much higher likelihood that it would be used for good on people that you have a much more personal – you've vetted them that if you give an extension of what you're doing, there's a better there's a better understanding or assumption that they will use it for good.
I think, yeah, just I guess charity begins at home. Mm-hmm. So if I know that my actual neighbor or my actual cousin or my brother or my sister is in trouble, I just think I prefer that versus, okay, so somebody in Honduras or Pakistan has a problem. I feel for those people, but I still have limited charity dollars and I just sort of want to pick my shots.
Yeah.
So
I'll go back to the other one real quick if that's all right.
Please
mentioned like, so happiness in terms of experience. And I would say yes to a degree, but the same thing is true there. It's how that experience is integrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, why do people like, you know, show slideshows of their, you know, experiences like to people back home and all that? Like,
yeah.
To some degree, it's always in service of what that kind of presents as opportunities to connect with other people. It adds to your story, your understanding of things. I had a conversation here recently with my father after my mom passed away, and like they used to travel quite a bit. Okay. One thing that he mentioned, and we had this conversation pretty melancholically, is just we talked about like, you know, him traveling different places. He's like, honestly, like if I don't have somebody like to go with, like I'm like there's no point to travel. Like, his whole thing is like I'm going to go visit, you know, friends and family. So he's pretty good about like going to visit people. But the idea of like going places became infinitely less interesting, and like you talked about, like,
right,
yeah, there's nowhere I want to go, there's no place I want to see, I'd have nobody to share or do that with.
Right.
So that like that lost its luster almost immediately, and then it became in favor of I want to go see friends and family and persons became more important.
That's really powerful.
And so it's a very interesting and very kind of sobering conversation of like there's a certain point, like, yeah, you can do things, but at some point, especially as you get older, it's like, well,
yeah,
the things become less important than the people with whom you do that.
And I would agree with that completely. People become everything.
I would say even like in college, I remember going on different vacations, and for me, a lot of it was just the difference. Like the stuff we did was fun. Don't get me wrong. Like we did different fun things. But for me, it's almost always like the people with whom we did it made all the difference, because that became part of like our inside jokes or part of our references to past things we've done or stories we tell new people as we integrated them into our group. Like, yeah, we went on this thing. This is what we did. And like we'd sell the story together. So, yeah, those experiences and like gaining knowledge and all that stuff. Well, it depends on what you do with them.
Okay.
Depends on how you sell that, how it's made you better, how you've incorporated that into your social network, how you've used those experiences to better other people or, let's say, your standing with them in some healthy way. Because, again, people don't exist completely in a vacuum. So I would say, well, it depends on what you do with those experiences.
That's right. I kind of buy into the whole Myers-Briggs personality, you know, the type indicator and all that. And I'm an ENFP.
Okay, sure.
You know, and the ENFs in general are, you know, when it comes to play, they don't really care what they do. They just care who they're doing it with. Mm-hmm. And that's me to 100, you know, because if somebody says, hey, let's do jiu-jitsu, I'm going to put you in a headlock, I'm going to do a takedown. I feel good about everybody who's in my class. I like all these people. Mm-hmm. And it's great. You know, so yes, choke me. That's totally fantastic, you know. But if I talk with somebody else and I don't know, like let's say I'm visiting with my cousins and, you know, their children come out and like some of their, you know, little kids, and they say, well, do you want to like, you know, see my dollhouse? You know, sure, absolutely. I mean, if it makes you happy, you know, then I just get excited looking at your excitement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, students have asked me, what's your favorite class to teach? And I've taught in 26 different types of classes. I've taught English, math, social studies, personal finance. Honestly, I don't care. I like them all. Mm-hmm. It's who I'm teaching. Like, can you be motivated? Yeah, I always kind of split students into three categories. Already motivated, can be motivated, can't be motivated. And that last group, okay, I wish they could take a different class that would excite them, put them in auto mechanics or something else that they, or advanced calculus 9, something that they would enjoy, you know, just don't make them suffer. So that's,
A personal example of that's kind of fun. So I'm a INFJ. So I have the NF in there as far as but I'm more introverted than I am extroverted overall. Okay. But one thing I'm thinking about, like, so I have this group of guy friends we've known for quite a while, and different members have entered in and out with their wives over time. And I'm just thinking about like some of the most fun things we've done, like the experiences, like oftentimes aren't all that expensive. Like some things we've done together that like different places we've gone or things that we've done or we've invested in like all that. But some of the most fun things we do, like I'd never heard of this thing. Like one of my friends is kind of more of a country guy and I'd never heard of this. Like, so we go every once in a while, like we've done this like once a year where we'll just like have the guys day for going out to Ghidorah and hang out and just like just be around each other for several hours, right?
Okay.
And
hanging out with the guys.
We do different fun things and probably like the most fun thing that we do, funnily as it might sound, right?
Okay.
One of the most fun things that we do that we remember, like that's like our staple, that's just the most fun thing, is this game that, I don't know if it's invented by whom, but it's this game called Stump, right?
Okay, I've never heard of this.
Okay, super basic, but that's like the most fun thing that like all of our other activities, all the things we bring and purchase and work on, like all circle around, like this is the fun thing that we do, right?
Okay.
And all it is, it's hilariously fun, but it's just like us all just talking and engaging with each other. The experience is not all that expensive, right? So he just has like these like literal like just, you know, wood stumps, like chunks of trees, right? And you should get a bunch of like 9-inch like long nails. Put them all like, you know, maybe like a centimeter into the wood in a circle in front of each player. And each player gets to choose one of a variety of different hammers. And the goal is you're trying to, like, everyone gets one turn at a time and you're hammering in everybody else's nails. You want your nail to be the last one in.
Oh, okay.
So super simple. Not a complicated thing, right? But that is like the most fun that we have. Like, of all the other things that we do and purchase, like, we've had like the like different guys that brought guns, like shot things who are out in the boonies. And like, he bought a nice go-kart thing for us to kind of drive around.
Okay.
It's like just different fun things, right?
Yeah.
The most fun that we have is like
playing
this
Stump.
Like this box of nails and hammers that he just like we have just different hammers for. And again, like how much could that box of nails be? Like maybe like $10 for like a whole set of them. And that's like the thing we spend hours doing, just talking, just reminiscing, going over things, and just like playing this game, just like laughing our heads off the whole time. It's like,
that's great.
Yeah, the experience is certainly more about the persons. Like, yeah, we enjoy the other things. They're novelties. We enjoy them for 5 minutes. They're very fun.
Right.
But most of the time just spent just engaging with each other, doing something fun, enjoyable.
Well, and that might be a good place to wrap up the segment of the discussion on happiness, because just to sort of, I guess, summarize a little bit of where we've been so far, I wanted to know, can money actually buy happiness? And I'm still pretty much convinced that it can, and you've refined quite a bit of my thinking that, yes, charity, if I do charity the right way, I can buy happiness. Experiences, you know, if I do experiences the right way, if I come into a big pile of money, like say $2-3 million, and if I got there through avoidance, like maybe lottery tickets, I'm probably going to lose it and be less happy. But if I got there through adaptation, growing and becoming a better person, like I'm building, I'm constructing, I'm failing, I'm succeeding, I'm growing, then that's a form of happiness. And then this last one, I guess I'm just going to call it cheaper but more fun. And this is something I have my personal finance students do, which is, okay, whatever you're doing, write it down on a sheet of paper and then think of something that would be cheaper but more fun. And so now you're having more fun, so you don't have to worry about self-discipline because, well, we've eliminated the need for that, but it's also cheaper. Mm. And so like this Stump game, it's super fun. And you guys, it's just silly. And it's like, I don't know, it's like any like of those type of games, like where kids are tackling each other or whatever. You know, it's free.
Mm.
You know, just a very similar example that I'll give is one time I was with my nieces. This was quite a number of years ago. And I took their parents and both nieces ziplining. And, you know, I got a thing on Groupon, and so it was cheaper, but ziplining is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how much it was per person, but it was quite a big chunk of money. And for whatever reason, everybody was in kind of a bad mood. And so we didn't even have any fun with the damn ziplining. And I'd been ziplining before, and I love it. It's you know, it's like a roller coaster. It's great. Well, anyway, that afternoon we went home, and then with one of the nieces, I was playing board games. She just loves board games. We were just like laughing and howling and just having a really good time. And I thought, this is basically free, you know, and we just had so much more fun. And so I thought, well, cheaper and more fun. We should have just stayed home and played board games all day, and we would have had a great time. The other thing was expensive, and it was time-consuming, and it was a hassle, and people were sourpusses, and it's just funny how that works out. That's what I'm hearing from the game of Stump.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so we talked about that, and then I think we also talked about Dave Ramsey, about how Dave Ramsey is useful unless you treat it like a fundamentalist religion. You know, if it's going to be Dave Ramsey plus ISIS plus veganism, then that's probably a recipe for unhappiness. So, okay, and then we also, I think, talked about the need for love and trust among couples, you know, and adapting to each other. And I'd like to do one more episode on this, and maybe next time I hope we talk about Robert Kiyosaki.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
And also, how about some major crises? Like, how do people handle major crises?
Perfect.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Thank you so much, Adam.
You bet.
Okay.